All right. We were in the first of the chapters of the units of this unit, got up to slide 10. I haven't talked about this yet. The main point here is that energy that gets stored in the form of ATP, which is one of the main things that this entire unit talks about, that energy is put to use to do work in cells. And there are, as you see here, two major categories of work that gets done in cells. At the top, you have transport work. Well, transport refers to moving things around, but here specifically what they really should have written is transmembrane transport, meaning movement of things either into or out of a cell through the membrane. That's what transmembrane means. And pumps are great examples of that. I've already told you that we call transporters that work for active transport pumps. And we looked at a couple examples, right? The sodium potassium exchange pump, proton pump, there's other pumps as well. But whenever there is the forcing of some sort of particle against its gradient, in other words, moving it in the opposite direction from how it wants to move based on its gradient, that requires an external expenditure of energy, and that external expenditure of energy is often in the form of ATP. So transmembrane transport work is one major kind, and there's also what is termed here mechanical work, which is about moving things from place to place within a cell. We've looked at examples of this before with motor proteins, which you're looking at again right here. Motor proteins walk along microtubules that are part of the cytoskeleton, and the motor protein carries a vesicle containing some cargo, the thing that's trying to be moved, or the thing that needs to be moved, and that's an expensive process. Every individual step along the way by that motor protein requires a fresh ATP. Now, when we use ATP, well, the reason that ATP is so valuable, as we talked about last time, is that there's chemical energy in the bonds between the phosphates. An ATP molecule has three phosphates hooked end to end. And so there's a couple phosphate-phosphate bonds, one between the third and second, one between the second and the first. And ATP has more energy than ADP because it has that additional phosphate-phosphate bond. That's where the energy is stored temporarily in the form of ATP. That energy came originally from fuel, food that the cell exists on. We'll talk more about that later. But when it's time to use that stored energy that's been stored in ATP, we get that energy by dephosphorylating ATP, meaning take that third phosphate off of ATP, leaving just two, and that's why it turns into ADP. ADP we've been talking about this analogy with currency, and I said the better analogy really for ATP is a debit card, because ATP is like a debit card with a higher balance. ADP still has a positive balance, so it can still be used for something, but it's has less energy than ATP. And when you dephosphorylate ATP to produce ADP, that of course leaves an inorganic phosphate, a phosphate just by itself. Well, we can recharge this ADP by hooking phosphate back onto it, but that's going to require energy from fuel. And so it's a continuous shuttling back and forth between these two forms, ADP and ATP, to produce those different kinds of work. We can see that again in slide 11. And this really, in schematic form, illustrates the idea that ATP is the energetic middleman. Last time I was saying that currency is like a middleman because you don't work directly for your needs, right? You work for money, and then you can spend the money on your needs, like housing and food and stuff. Similarly, in a cell, the energy that's released by burning the fuels from food, that energy is not directly used to power the endergonic processes that require energy in the cell. Instead, there's this energetic middleman, ATP. Well, the energy that comes from burning the fuels is sufficient to phosphorylate ADP, meaning stick another phosphate onto ADP to produce ATP, and now that ATP is storing some of the energy that was in the fuel. But then it doesn't hang around in ATP form very long, because the next moment that cell is going to need to spend some of that energy, and it spends it from ATP by dephosphorylating ATP. That releases the energy that was originally in the food, but now has just been in the ATP, and that can power the endergonic process. It's much more versatile this way. Otherwise, you would have to have different fuels for each of the different kinds of endergonic processes. ATP is just like money in that respect, right? You don't have to have a certain job for your housing, and a certain job for your food, and a certain job for your clothing. You do one job for money, which can be spent on all of those things. All right, 12. This should kind of look familiar to you, because we've talked a little bit about what's going on here in previous chapters, including the chapter that had to do with macromolecules. What kind of molecule are we looking at here? It's a disaccharide, specifically sucrose, which is table sugar to us. It's what most plants temporarily store their food that they create themselves so that they can move it around in the plant. But anyway, sucrose is a disaccharide. You're correct, because it's made out of two monosaccharides that are hooked together with what kind of bond? What bonds hold together monosaccharides to form higher, more complex carbohydrates? Those are called glycosidic linkages. So there's a glycosidic linkage holding these two constituent monosaccharides together, which is why this is not a monosaccharide, it's a disaccharide. Right? That's the glycosidic linkage. The reason this is in this chapter as well is that if the cell wants to break this sucrose disaccharide into two monosaccharides, well, first of all, one good reason for doing that is because if you want to use this as fuel, you can't use sucrose as fuel, you have to use monosaccharides, and therefore you need to break the monosaccharides in the disaccharide apart so that they are just individual monosaccharides. But anyway, doing that means that you need to break the glycosidic linkage. And like I was talking about before, effectively all chemical reactions occurring in cells, all the reactions that make up metabolism, don't happen without help. Almost all of them require the help of a catalyst. And what do we call biological catalysts?
Enzymes.
Right, enzymes. Well, at least for almost all the instances. I'll talk later about the fact that we eventually realize that there are some other things that serve as biological catalysts, but effectively all biological catalysts are enzymes. And what kind of molecules are enzymes?
Polypeptides.
Right. They are proteins, and the enzyme that's working in this case is called sucrase. Now, not all enzymes have a name that ends in ASE, but a lot of them do. And so when you see ASE, you should know that you're dealing with something that is an enzyme. Enzymes get their names, the specific name that an individual enzyme has, usually in one of two ways. Some enzymes are named for what they do, and some enzymes are named for their substrate. The substrate is the reactant that the enzyme as a catalyst binds to temporarily to accelerate the reaction. So keep in mind what a catalyst does in general. A catalyst is not a reactant. It does not get changed into a product. And a catalyst is not necessary for a reaction to occur. But if a catalyst is not present, even though that reaction can occur, it's not necessarily going to happen very fast. And therefore, biology or living things require the help of catalysts so that the reactions that need to happen happen soon enough for them to remain alive. That's what enzymes are all about. All right, so but back to this idea of a catalyst not being a reactant. It is not a reactant. The substrate is the reactant. And so we use the word substrate simply to, I mean, it's just a different name for a reactant, but when you say substrate, you know that it's not only a reactant, but that reaction that it's part of is being helped by a catalyst, okay? Anyway, the substrate binds to the enzyme, as we'll look at closer in a little bit, and something about that binding allows for the reaction to occur a lot more easily, and therefore enzymes working as catalysts speed up reactions millions of times faster than they would occur without the help. Yeah.
How do you spell substrate?
S-U-B-S-T-R-A-T-E. And so I was saying that some enzymes are named for what they do, like dehydrogenases that we'll look at in a minute. Others, though, are named for their specific substrate, and that's why this one is called sucrase, because the substrate, the reactant that binds to this enzyme, is sucrose. Sucrase is the corresponding enzyme. Importantly, though, enzymes are specific. I got into this a little bit last time. There is no such thing as one master enzyme, and you would not want that to be the case, because then it would work to speed up all possible chemical reactions in the cell, and that is never what a cell wants. It would kill the cell. You have to be able to turn certain reactions on and keep others from happening. That's what enzyme control is all about. So each individual different kind of reaction requires its own different kind of protein acting as a specific enzyme. This one is sucrase. Now, based on what you see happening here, what kind of reaction is this?
Hydrolysis.
It's a hydrolysis, and hydrolysis splits things, right, with the help of water. That's why it's hydrolysis. So you're talking about splitting a bigger, more complex thing into smaller, less complex things. Therefore, what other word could you use to describe this? When I talked about the pairs of antonyms that you need to know, remember the three pairs of antonyms? If you're talking about breaking things apart, then you could also call this catabolic, right? If it worked in reverse, from bottom to top in the screen, that would be anabolic, building the sucrose, but this is splitting it apart. And what word corresponds to that that you would use to determine whether energy is released or required? What do you expect a catabolic reaction to be on energetic grounds?
Exergonic.
Exergonic, exactly. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about enzymes in slide 13. In this graph, notice that the y-axis is free energy. What's the symbol for free energy? No, it's G just by itself. And that's important because delta G requires two values of G, right, to compute, a before and an after. So any individual point along this black trace, any single point has an X and a Y value, right? The Y value is the G at that moment, because the X-axis is time, progress of the reaction. But you start before the reaction occurs and you end after the reaction happens. And G, the value of free energy, changes along the way. That's the black trace. Now, the letters are just generic. It's not really a specific example, but you can see that you start with some reactants involving some atoms arranged with each other a certain way, and then you end up with products that are a rearrangement of atoms, as occurs in any given chemical reaction. All right, now, speaking of delta G, what do we know about the delta G of here? You can cheat and look, but if it weren't even listed, how would you know that delta G is negative here?
Because it goes below like where it started in the reactions.
Right. The G is here at first, the G is here after, and delta G is always G final minus G initial. So it's smaller minus bigger, that's always going to be a negative number. And what does negative delta G tell you? It means it's spontaneous, so that means it can happen on its own. Can happen on its own, not necessarily will. What else corresponds to negative delta G? Catabolic in general have negative delta G, that's true. And what other word? Exergonic. So this is an exergonic reaction. All right? Now, one really important thing to understand about delta G, well, oh, I'll actually get to that. Let me say that this could be drawn for an endergonic reaction. I mean, you could have a corresponding graph for an endergonic reaction that would be similar. You'd have a starting G and an ending G, but the starting G would be lower than the ending G, right? So it would look like this. That would be an endergonic trace. Okay, now, the thing that we haven't talked about at all before this graph is that any given reaction features this value right here, which is a change in free energy, but it's a change just from where it was originally to the top of this hill. Okay? So it's the difference in G here and in here, which has a special name called the energy of activation, or the activation energy, or in symbols, E sub A. Notice that at the top of this hill is the so-called transition state. You started with reactant, that's some stuff. You're ending with products, that's some different stuff. The point here is that any given chemical reaction, what's really happening is that some bonds are being broken and other bonds are being formed. But that doesn't happen instantaneously. It doesn't just blink into product form. There is a stuff that is not any longer reactant, but it's not yet product. That's the transition state. And the curved lines here represent bonds that are not actually broken yet and the new ones haven't formed yet. And in any given reaction, there is a transition state, including this endergonic one that I drew. All right. The E sub A for this one, by the way, would be this value. Not all the way down here. Okay? In other words, the energy of activation is how much higher the G is than whichever is the higher G of reactants and products. It's the size of the hill, the additional hill. Well, the transition state has such a high G because it is very, very unstable, which is why no reaction is ever going to stop at the reaction state. You have to go through the reaction state in order for the products to get formed. But it's very, very highly unstable, which goes along with what I was saying about G in general when we first looked at those examples, like jumping off the diving platform or diffusing. Remember those examples in that one slide? High G corresponds to instability. And things tend to go downhill G-wise because they become more stable. Okay. Similarly with the transition state. It is very unstable, that's why it has a high G. But because you have to go through it, that means even on an exergonic reaction like this, you actually have to go uphill in energy to a certain amount for it to happen. Then it will easily go downhill from there. If you think about it as a literal hill, yeah.
Is that why like some reactions are like temperature dependent?
That's right. That's exactly right. Even exergonic reactions, which are spontaneous and can happen, aren't necessarily going to happen anytime soon because they might not have the thermal energy to get over this hill. And that's why heating them up would make this happen a lot quicker. Heating up reactions is one way of speeding them up. Of course, that has some drawbacks, right? Like the heat might kill an organism if this is a reaction occurring in a cell. Well, one of the major points of this slide is that another way of getting the reaction to happen more quickly is with the help of an enzyme. Right? And this is a graph shown for a non-catalyzed reaction. So this, whatever reaction this represents, this is without the help of an enzyme. Okay? So it has a specific value for activation energy. Now, a really important thing... Well, no, I'm going to show you one more graph before I tell you that important thing. This 14 is the same exact graph for the black trace. Okay, nothing has changed here except we didn't show you the molecules anymore. Exactly the same trace. The red trace is exactly the same reaction, but this time it's happening with the help of an enzyme. And notice what has happened as far as G is concerned in the red trace. E sub A is smaller when there's an enzyme involved. This is what E sub A is without the enzyme. In other words, enzymes operate by lowering activation energy. They somehow make the hill that you have to get over energetically smaller. And if they make it small enough, then the thermal energy that's available is enough to get you over the hill. And it will happen. Now, specific enzymes, because each enzyme is specific for a given reaction, specific enzymes work differently depending on, it's a case-by-case basis. For instance, some enzymes break things apart. Well, one way this could happen is that if the substrate, like sucrase in that example, binds to the enzyme, that binding causes stress in the bond between the two parts, the two monosaccharides in that example, and it would make it easier to break, for instance. If some enzymes work by building things up, and so multiple substrates have to come in, and by binding they might become put just into the right orientation with each other so that they will react easily. Then there's all kinds of ways that enzymes can specifically work, but they all work in general by doing something to lower activation energy. And just as importantly, now I can finally tell you what I started telling you twice, is that no enzyme ever changes the value of delta G. Notice that right here. Delta G is just the difference between starting G and ending G. That's exactly the same even when an enzyme is involved. Only this change in G is involved, which is the activation energy. The delta G of any reaction is defined only by the reactants and products, G's themselves. And if an enzyme is not involved, or if it is involved, does not change that. Okay, so this is delta G. This is E sub A. All right, 15. This is a picture of an enzyme in blue and some substrate that it's specific for in red. And on the left version, in the before, which is on the left, there hasn't been any binding yet, but I've already told you that the substrate is simply the reactant that binds to an enzyme in a catalyzed reaction. It's not just anywhere, though, that the substrate binds to on the enzyme. It's a specific part of the surface of the enzyme, a specific shape, and that place is called the active site. So any given enzyme has an active site. That's the business end of the enzyme, in effect, because that's where the substrate or substrates bind. This is yet another example of a ligand binding to a protein, right? The enzyme is a protein. The substrate is a ligand in this case because it's binding to a protein. And so I'll ask you yet again, what is the general consequence of the binding of a ligand to a substrate? Well, what other examples of ligands binding to proteins have we had? We talked about it happening in certain proteins that are embedded in the bilayer.
Yes.
But for instance, we talked about signal transduction. Signals are ligands, right? And what happened when a signal bound to the receptor protein? It doesn't necessarily break off. The general consequence of any ligand binding to a protein is that there is a conformational change in the protein. The protein changes shape because of that binding. And that goes for enzymes as well, because enzymes are proteins. All right? So we can see this here. Notice the shape of the active site before it binds. It's not the same as after it binds. The substrate comes in, and first of all, this substrate is allowed in because it's the right shape to begin with. That's why enzymes are specific, because of their shapes. And also because of their chemical affinity for a certain substance. But once that substrate comes in, which the fit is already pretty good between the substrate and the enzyme before there's a shape change. But after it comes in and binds, the fit between the enzyme and the substrate gets even better. And we call that induced fit. Because induce means to bring about. It's the shape change that brings about an even better fit between the enzyme and the substrate, in other words. And this is a little bit like passive handshaking versus active handshaking. You know, some people just put their hand out, they don't really grab you. Others give you a firm handshake. That's kind of what induced fit is like. The enzyme is really hugging that substrate. And that is good because it makes it even more isolated away from the surroundings. And therefore, it can do the job of lowering the activation energy, however it does, to make that reaction more likely to happen. And as we see labeled here, once the substrate does bind to the enzyme, we call the whole thing, enzyme and substrate, the enzyme-substrate complex. That's temporary. This binding is temporary because of things I've already told you. The enzyme's not a reactant, the substrate is. So the substrate's going to get turned into product and then leave the enzyme, and the enzyme will go back into its original unbound shape and be reusable. That's a hallmark of catalysts. They're reusable. They don't get used up because they're not reactants. We can see that in cartoon form in 16. Here we have an example in which the enzyme has two substrates that come into the active site. The induced fit isn't shown here, but there is a shape change that happened. Well, actually, it is shown because this is the original shape. Now it's a slightly different shape. The activation energy gets lowered for whatever reason in this specific example, but that causes the reaction to occur, which transforms red and green into Ukrainian colors, which is the products, and those get released, and that leaves the enzyme back in its original unbound shape, ready to go again, which is a good point because, as I was saying before, cells need to control whether reactions are occurring. They want to turn them on or off as appropriate. Well, if this enzyme is still here, and if there is still these substrates, whatever they are, then the reaction is going to continue for as long as that enzyme is there. Without the enzyme's help, it is so slow that it is effectively turned off. So it's important for a cell to let this particular enzyme hang around only so long as it's needed. It needs to, and we can and sometimes shut the enzyme off so that it won't continue to work. But without that control of the enzyme, it would just simply continue to work forever, and that would be inappropriate. I'll talk more about that in a different slide, but first let's go to 17. Look at another couple graphs. Here you have the same y-axis in both. It's the rate of the reaction. In other words, the higher you are on the y-axis, the better the enzyme is doing its job of speeding up that particular reaction, whatever it is. And therefore, the peak on each trace is the best condition. But what differs in the two graphs is in the x-axis is the condition. So it's temperature on the top one, it's pH for the bottom. Well, I've mentioned temperature and pH a couple times already this term as being variables that are particularly important for affecting the shapes of proteins, right? I mentioned it first when we were talking about acid precipitation. Acidification of rain is changing the pH of the environment. And that's one variable that drastically can change the shape of proteins in general. Well, enzymes are proteins. Temperature is another one, though. And there's other variables that can affect shapes of proteins, but especially temperature and pH. Even a small change in either of those, in either direction, can drastically affect the shape of the protein. And it's not just enzymes, but proteins in general have their specific jobs that they're able to perform because of their specific shapes. So if you start messing with the shape of enzymes, which control metabolism because all these reactions rely on the help of the enzymes, then you can be in trouble as a cell. We can see that on the traces here. The top one is two different enzymes that do the same job, but in two different organisms. The black one is an enzyme that works in humans. The red one is from a thermophilic or heat-loving bacterium. These are bacteria that live at the boiling point of water, which would kill almost all other organisms. But these not only survive it, they actually thrive in that condition. They're doing the same job. In other words, they're catalyzing the same sort of reaction, but in these two different organisms. And notice where the peak is. Well, the peak for the black one that comes from humans is right about 38 degrees, which is average human body temperature. And that shouldn't surprise you. This is how natural selection works. There are different versions of this enzyme that occurred randomly because of mutation. But the one that was favored was the one that happens to have just the right shape at the temperature that humans actually have as their body temperature. You get higher than that or lower, and you drastically decrease the effectiveness, though, because the rate of the reaction goes down. It's because it doesn't have as good a shape anymore to speed it up as well. Well, the peak of the red one is right at the temperature that is great for that bacterium that loves that temperature. But notice, it is so high that our enzyme would be totally destroyed. It wouldn't work at all. The bottom one is the pH that's changing. And so here we, once again, have two enzymes that do the same job, But in this case, it's two from our own body doing the same job in different parts of the body. They're both digestive enzymes. They break apart proteins. But the black one breaks them apart in the stomach, which has a much lower pH, right? Because of the hydrochloric acid that the stomach produces. pH of 2 or even lower. Well, notice where the optimum is, just below 2. So it's working at just the right pH for where it's supposed to be working. When that stuff that's in the stomach, which is called chyme, you don't have to know that word, gets delivered to the next part of the digestive tract, which is the small intestine, the beginning of the small intestine, there's no longer such a low pH. It goes to a much more neutral pH, above 7 even, in this next step. So this enzyme that was working in the stomach very well immediately gets deactivated once that stuff gets put into the next part of the body, because now it's at a pH that's so high that it totally denatures the enzyme, changes the shape so that it's worthless. That's not a problem, though, because then the small intestine makes its own version of an enzyme that works at that new pH of the small intestine. The major point, though, for both of these graphs is that any given enzyme has an optimal pH and an optimal temperature, meaning the conditions at which it has just the right shape to maximize its effectiveness as a catalyst. All right, now let's talk more about this control of enzymes I was mentioning earlier. This is slide 18. And we've already talked about what's shown in A here. It's just shown here again for reference. This is just normal binding, meaning that the enzyme has a specifically shaped active site, which is fits nicely with a given substrate that it's specific for. And therefore, if the enzyme and the substrate are both present, then there will be binding. Next, in B, though, we have what's called competitive inhibition. Let's think about the words here. First of all, inhibition refers to keeping something from happening. You're inhibiting the enzyme by making it no longer able to work as a catalyst, as well, at least. Right? So this is part of the control of enzymes. Enzymes can be either inhibited or activated, turned off or turned on, in other words. By the way, let me say that one way that you could inhibit a catalyzed reaction, turn off a reaction, in other words, or effectively turn it off, is to simply destroy the enzyme, right? If you destroy the enzyme, then it's no longer going to speed it up, and it'll be so slow that it's effectively turned off. That will work, of course. The problem with that is that the very next moment you might need it to be turned back on. And you just destroyed an enzyme that would do the job. Now it's going to take time and energy to build a brand new enzyme, which you can always do, by the way, because you can go back to the DNA. That gene that tells the cell how to build that particular enzyme is always going to be there in the library. You can go back, figure out how to build it, and build a new one. But that takes time and energy. So it's expensive in two ways to do that. It would be much better if you could keep the enzyme there, but turn it on or turn it off with a switch, in a sense. And that's exactly what's happening here with control of enzymes that we're looking at. First, though, is competitive inhibition. So this is a switching of an enzyme, but it's specifically switching it off if this happens. Now, we have two, besides the enzyme, we have two different kinds of particles here. One is the normal substrate, right? It has just the right shape for the active site of the enzyme, and if it binds to the active site of the enzyme, it will get turned into product. We have this blue thing, though, here, which is an inhibitor. And it's called a competitive inhibitor, specifically, because this inhibitor can also bind to the active site of the enzyme. So in a sense, the substrate which is the thing that's normally supposed to go into the active site, and the inhibitor, the blue thing, are competing to get into that same active site. They're vying for the attention of that active sites, of that enzyme's active site. All right, that's what makes it specifically a competitive inhibitor. The competitive inhibitor is not a substrate, meaning it will not get turned into something else. By binding to the active site, the competitive inhibitor simply gets in the way. It blocks the active site, and therefore, even if there is substrate present, it can't get in, at least not on this copy of the enzyme. There will be thousands of identical copies of the same enzyme doing the same thing, but at any given moment, an enzyme that has a competitive inhibitor hooked to it might as well not be there. It's switched off. It's not doing the job of catalysis. Okay, now that's not a permanent situation. The competitive inhibitor can leave as well. And if it does, then this enzyme would be switched back on. Now, before I get to the third one, I'll go to the third one first. That would make more sense. The third one, C, is non-competitive inhibition. This is still inhibition that's happening here. In other words, this is turning the enzyme off for the moment. And it's still using a different particle called an inhibitor, different meaning other than the substrate. But what makes it non-competitive is that it is not competing with the substrate for the active site because they bind at different places. The substrate is able to bind to the active site. The non-competitive inhibitor is binding to some place on the enzyme other than the active site. Well, this is another example of a ligand binding to a protein, right? The non-competitive inhibitor is a ligand. It's binding to the enzyme, which is a protein. So the general consequence is that there will be a change in shape, a conformational change, in the enzyme, the protein. And in this case, the reason that inhibits the enzyme is that the shape change that it undergoes changes the shape of the active site itself. It gets deformed. So it's not that the active site is blocked. It just gets misshapen, and therefore, even if there is substrate there, it can't fit in at the moment. That's why it's non-competitive inhibition, though. These two are not competing for the same active site. All right? Either one of those will turn the enzyme off. It will deactivate it without destroying it. So it can be reversed to turn it back on. Now, the next slide is going to look at activation, which is the opposite of inhibition. Activation can turn an enzyme on. But first I want you to make sense by looking at this middle cartoon that if it's a competitive control, that can only ever be inhibition, right? It wouldn't make sense to have competitive activation because competitive means it's blocking the active site. All right. Well, another word for non-competitive control is allosteric. Allosteric refers to the binding of the control molecule, the red thing in this case, to some place other than the active site. Okay, that's allosteric control. And allosteric or non-competitive control can occur in either of the two directions. In other words, there can be non-competitive inhibition, which we just looked at, but there can also be non-competitive or allosteric activation, which is what's shown in slide 19. And allosteric activation, in this example, is being shown for an enzyme, the purple thing, that is a multimeric protein. Not all enzymes are as simple as the ones we just looked at. This one consists of four identical polypeptide subunits, right? So it's one of these proteins that are multimeric and they have quaternary structure, right? Because they have individual polypeptides making them up. Each individual polypeptide is in itself really an enzyme with its own active site. So this enzyme overall can catalyze four different copies of the substrate, whatever it is, which in this case is shown in blue, the thing that can fit into the active site. So there's four different places in this example where it can bind. But notice this oscillation set of arrows here. This enzyme, without anything bound to it, substrate or regulator, can exist in either of two shapes, two forms. And so it, many times per second, is going back and forth between these two shapes. One of them is the active form, because in that shape, the active sites are the right shape to hold substrates, and therefore it can operate as an enzyme. In the inactive form, notice that the misshapen active sites can't let substrate in. So the enzyme by itself is continuously going back and forth between on and off, in a sense. But then you have these green and red things, which are allosteric regulators in general. But an allosteric regulator can be either an allosteric activator, something that will turn on the enzyme, or an allosteric inhibitor, something that will turn off the enzyme. And in this case, they do this by, well, first of all, they're allosteric, so that tells you that they're either activating or inhibiting by binding somewhere on that enzyme other than the active site. That's, by definition, what allosteric means. The green allosteric activator has the right shape to fit right in here, which is not the active site, but when it does that, it will lock the enzyme into this active form. And it will no longer be going back and forth between its two shapes. And when it locks it in this form, then these active sites are open and available to substrate, and it will work as an enzyme. The red one, though, is an allosteric inhibitor, and it binds in here to lock it in the inactive form. So this keeps it turned off for as long as the red thing is bound here. Even if there's substrate around, it can't fit into the active sites because they're all misshapen. So this is a very useful thing, because you don't have to destroy the enzyme to keep it from working when you don't want it to work. You simply need to have the correct kind of allosteric inhibitor around to turn it off for the moment. Or to turn it on, you have to have the right kind of allosteric activator. And by controlling enzymes, the cell accomplishes something even more important, which is the control of that specific chemical reaction that the enzyme catalyzes. And when you control individual reactions, you can also control the whole pathway that that individual reaction is a part of. So with a single switch on a single kind of enzyme, you can shut down or turn on entire biochemical pathways. As a matter of fact, that's what is shown as an example here in slide 20. This is an example of what is called feedback inhibition, as you see in the red square here. Feedback inhibition is inhibition of an enzyme. So it's turning off an enzyme. But it's also an example of feedback. Feedback, as we've talked about it already, is important in homeostasis, right? There's two different kinds of feedback, though, remember. What is the only kind of feedback that can lead to homeostasis? Negative feedback. Positive feedback always makes the error, whatever it is, even worse. Negative feedback gets rid of the error and brings the variable back to where it should be. Well, here we have a biochemical pathway. In this case, it's five steps. Each step is catalyzed by its own reaction, own enzyme. But you start with threonine, that's the initial substrate. It gets converted into different things along the way, but eventually it ends up being turned into isoleucine. That's the final product of the pathway. And isoleucine, for whatever reason, is needed by the cell at this moment, which is why this chemical, biochemical pathway is being run. That's why it's turned on, because the cell needs the end product, isoleucine. All right? As long as it continues to need isoleucine, then the isoleucine that gets produced will be used. And the error is very low in that case, because the amount of isoleucine is appropriate. All right? Eventually, though, there will be enough isoleucine already. The cell doesn't need any more. Well, if you still have threonine in the initial substrate, and these enzymes are still present, then it doesn't matter that you don't need any more isoleucine. It's going to still be built, right? Because all these things are still in place. That's going to lead to an error. The error is you have too much isoleucine at the moment. And so an error calls for negative feedback to reduce that error. Feedback inhibition does the job. Because in this case, isoleucine itself, the final product that is starting to build up now that the cell doesn't need anymore, it actually operates as an allosteric inhibitor on this first enzyme. So if isoleucine is being used by the cell, it's not going to become a factor, it's not going to interfere with the enzyme because it's going to be used by the cell as fast as it's being produced. But once it builds up, that extra isoleucine becomes more and more likely to interfere with this first enzyme by binding allosterically to it, by binding somewhere other than the active site. That changes the shape, deforms the active site, and so threonine can no longer bind in there, and that turns off this first reaction. But if you turn off this first reaction, you turn off all the whole pathway, because you can't get to the second reaction without having the product of the first reaction. So it's typical that feedback inhibition operates on the first or an early enzyme in the pathway. Even though you could turn the whole pathway off, I mean, you could turn off production of more isoleucine by turning off any of these individual enzymes, right? Why does it make sense to turn off enzyme 1 rather than one of the other enzymes? That's right. Why go to the expense of building all these intermediates just to be stopped later? It's more efficient energetically and in terms of materials if you shut it off up here. And that's what usually happens. And so that's how the cell senses. I mean, that's how it controls the enzyme, the biochemical pathway automatically. Eventually, though, it's going to need isoleucine again, right? And when it does, it's going to start using what's been built up and interfering with the enzymes, and that's going to take them away from the enzymes, turning the enzyme back on because it's no longer bound as a regulator, and that's going to turn the pathway back on and start making isoleucine again, which is appropriate when it needs it again. So it will go back and forth between those automatically. That is the chapter 1.